Welcome everyone to this special bonus edition of Mindshift Podcast. I am super excited to finally be talking to Kamila Didina, originally from Poland, but now you're living in Dublin, Ireland, one of my favorite places to visit. So welcome to Mindshift Podcast.
Thank you so much, Clint. Very happy to be here.
I'm so glad to be talking to you. We had a couple of delays in there, but we finally made it happen. And I'm glad that we're getting this episode out before your film comes out. Well, it's not the film coming out, but it's actually the GoFundMe project. That's what I meant to say. That actually ends this Sunday, the 8th of December. Isn't that right? You're trying to raise funds for a very important movie that you're trying to put together.
That is correct. I'm crowdfunding on Indiegogo, actually, to pay for the production of the film. And indeed, I have only a few days left now. I'm looking into a way to extend the campaign, which may be a possibility. I'm not sure yet. But for the time being, it ends indeed on the 8th of December. And I am at an absolutely astonishing 25% of my target.
That's amazing. So was that more than you thought you were going to have?
I was being a bit ironic there. But yeah, if you guys are listening to it and if the story of the film that we will be discussing resonates with you, by all means, if you just Google debutante short film, you're very likely to find it on Indiegogo there on like first or second search result on the first page of Google.
Yeah, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes of the podcast. So if people want to find the link, I watched your, it's about 4 or 5 minute video that you talk about this movie. And I'm absolutely fascinated to talk. I don't want to get too much into the story yet because we're going to get there, I'm sure, aren't we? We'll talk about the movie, but essentially it's about the experience of being shunned. You're a former Jehovah's Witness yourself. So you've come out of the Jehovah's Witness, isn't that right? So you were raised in it. What's your backstory?
I was a Jehovah's Witness indeed. I wasn't quite raised in the religion. I think I was about 10, maybe 9 years old when my mother started hanging out with Jehovah's Witnesses and I just kind of followed. Prior to that, we were a standard sort of Polish Catholic family, but we weren't really very, you know, engaged or particularly religious. We just kind of were, you know, standard issue of the Catholics. But yeah, so I followed my mom into the, you know, the meetings, and then I had my own Bible study as a kid. And very quickly I got hooked on this religion. In particular, I suppose you could say I was a vulnerable child in a psychological way because my dad was an alcoholic and my mom was, you know, she had her own issues because of that, obviously. So both of us were quite vulnerable and susceptible to a group of people who embraced us with love, as Jehovah's Witnesses did. So, you know, the love bombing, the feeling of belonging, the feeling of being unconditionally nearly accepted and welcome.
Community, isn't it? It's an accepting, loving community. It seems so wonderful from the outset. You're welcomed, you're loved, and it's wonderful. What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly, and it's addictive. I found it was addictive, you know. I was very hungry for that approval as a kid, and I got loads of it in there. As soon as I discovered this sort of this pattern, this mechanism, you know, if I was particularly active as this child interested in the religion of Jehovah's Witnesses, say if I went to a meeting and, you know, I volunteered to answer a question during the study of the Watchtower article, they just loved it and they went crazy. It's like, oh my God, you're so amazing, you little
star pupil.
Yeah, and oh, and this was, you know, and very quickly I discovered this kind of dependency between those two or this pattern and I just wanted more and more of it. So I became more and more and more active as a Jehovah's Witness over the next number of years.
So you're finding this acceptance, this community. Was that the only place in your life at that point where you would find that kind of acceptance, given that your home life wasn't great?
Well, yeah, to a large extent it would be, yeah, because,
Short answer, yes.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, I can see where it becomes an addiction. Now, would you consider the Jehovah's Witness a cult? Because what you're just describing, you've hit, I think, three classic markers. You even use the words love bombing, which of course is classic cult recruitment techniques across the board. So what's your take on it now that you've left the organization, looking back on it?
Before I answer this question, I want to tell you that my personal mission is in life, especially as a filmmaker, is not in any way to destroy Jehovah's Witnesses or to cause them harm. Mm-hmm. I am not looking for that. I'm not interested in that. What I want to do is raise awareness among general public about the aspects of Jehovah's Witnesses community that are indeed dangerous and cult-like mm-hmm. to their members. And whatever I do, I always want to do it respectfully, with compassion. I just want to say that up front before I answer your question about whether or not they're a cult. Okay?
Right. So you have some caveats in there. No, I understand, because there are elements of evangelicalism where I come out of that are very much cult-like. It's hard to say that the whole organization is a cult, but there are some damaging psychological practices within it that are very hurtful to a lot of people. So
exactly.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from.
Exactly. So indeed, you know, I knew many good and honest and decent people in the organization of Jehovah's Witnesses. However, as a whole, I would have to say that the organization does have most, if not all, of the cult-specific behaviors.
Yeah, the markers.
Exactly. Such as the love bombing that we had mentioned, but also mm-hmm. very critically or importantly, the fact that the members are actively and strongly discouraged from both establishing friendships and or relationships with people who are not Jehovah's Witnesses, and also from any sort of exposure to literature or media or conversations with anyone who dares to criticize Jehovah's Witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a big red flag that it practically, like, I always just wonder how come I didn't see it. But then again, I was a kid, so whatever. But, you know, it's this thing, you're not allowed anyone who says anything critical about Jehovah's Witnesses, even when it comes to, like, studying their history in almost like an objective manner, you know, in 1975, you did say the Armageddon was going to be coming. You have it written.
Yeah, many times.
Yeah. Stuff like that is, I can't remember the exact name for it.
Was it old light, new light, revelation, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. No, that too. But
that's
but
the
in
explanation.
Terms of the cult, in terms of the cult-like mm-hmm. marker, I think there's an acronym for those, you know, behaviors that make a group a cult. And I can't remember.
Are you thinking of the BITE model? Stephen Hassan's BITE model?
That remind might be... me, what does BITE stand for? What do those letters stand for?
So the BITE model is behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotional control. And so he goes through and talks about every one of those. So you've just described information
control. Yeah.
So the flow of information from outside is or severely curtailed so that the members can't research the false prophecies and flaws within the organization and issues like childhood sexual abuse, which of course is a huge thing, massive, worldwide in the Watchtower organization. Most people in the organization don't know anything about that.
That is exactly true. And yes, so according to the BITE model as well, you know, you have the information control, you have the love bombing, but also... in terms of the emotional control, shunning is mm-hmm. the primary tool used to emotionally control Jehovah's Witnesses. Basically, you don't really hear that when you are becoming a Jehovah's Witness you're in the process of studying with them and they're all about encouraging you to join them. It's all about how great it's going to be in paradise and, you know, how wonderful you are for all your efforts, blah, blah, blah. But the minute you get baptized... and, you know, God forbid you have some doubts or, you know, mm-hmm. some years later you want to leave, the shunning is extreme and it's just mind-blowing, the cruelty of it. And furthermore, the psychological damage, you know, results in the people who commit the shunning, because they're told by their leaders that it is a loving provision.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas obviously, psychologically, from a human mammal perspective, like evolutionary almost, this thing of shunning and rejecting your children, for example, or your parents, mm-hmm. or any other family members, or anyone you loved as a friend, it goes against the fundamentals of who we are as people. And yet, you know, as the person who has to commit the shunning, you're telling your brain, you're trying to force it to think that it is a loving thing you're doing, even though every cell in your body is screaming that this is messed up and not right. But you have to like swallow this, you know, feeling and just
stuff it down. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is a horrendous tool of emotional control that Jehovah's Witnesses use that I think is incredibly damaging. Mm-hmm. I know of people who committed suicide because of being shunned, and it's, you know, it's one of the primary reasons why I set out to make my film as well. But that's, you know, we'll talk about it later. But so these are just some of those kind of cult-like markers, you know, that Jehovah's Witnesses have. And, you know, obviously, we haven't mentioned the elephant in the room, the blood transfusion refusal that is
mm-hmm.
kind of demanded.
People have died.
Yeah,
absolutely. You can't receive blood.
You're effectively, you know, giving the control over your life. Again, going, you know, if your child is sick and you're a parent, or if your wife is sick and you're a husband, but you're Jehovah's Witnesses, you literally you're expected to let them die. I respect people's right to professing. Is that a word? Professing a religion? Mm-hmm. Am I saying it right?
Yeah. You're professing. You're claiming to follow whatever religion.
Yeah. That's, you know, that's fine. Like, obviously we all, you know, it's a free world and there's no problem with that from mm-hmm. my end. However, when that religion literally demands you to allow your children or your family to die, mm-hmm. I think there has to be a line somewhere. And also, the one thing with blood transfusion that bothers me hugely is, you mentioned the new light or changing life. Mm-hmm. Jehovah's Witnesses have loosened their rule, if you will, of what's acceptable in terms of blood transfusion hugely in the past years, in the recent years. You know, in the 70s, you couldn't have any blood at all. But now you can have some fractions of blood, the white cells, but not the red cells or whatever, you know, or this fraction, but not that fraction of these globulins or whatever that's called, which makes no sense from a biblical point of view. What is driving me crazy is Jehovah's Witnesses never apologized for changing their doctrine. So what I always think about is, imagine, you know, you're 80 years old today, and in the 70s, your wife died, your beloved wife died. This is a random example. It's not a real story that I, you know, I don't know anyone like that, but I'm sure, you know, it happened.
Oh, there are people. Yeah, absolutely.
So imagine your wife died in the 70s because you had to refuse, both of you, the blood transfusion for her. And in the 90s or in, you know, 2007 or whatever, you get a new copy of the Watchtower and it says that actually these days, you know, you can't take this type of blood or whatever, which would have saved your wife.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was easily a treatable thing, but because she couldn't, imagine how angry you'd be.
To your mind. I actually think people who stay in the religion after that have to somehow compartmentalize that, because if they did allow themselves to feel what it makes them feel, I think they would have lost their mind. I think I would.
But there have been studies shown. There's a really good book called When Prophecy Fails by Dr. Leon Festinger, which is a fascinating study. It's a true study of a cult group, a UFO cult group in the United States. And these psychologists kind of infiltrated this cult and sort of posed as members. And this woman was predicting the end of the world. The saucer people were going to come down and take everybody away. And they were fascinated to see how this was going to play out. And of course, the saucer people didn't come and they didn't take everybody away. But what they found was shocking about the whole thing was, rather than abandon her as a false prophet and as a charlatan, these people doubled down and actually stayed with her and went on to kind of spread the word, if you will, across the country about the truth of her revelations, even though it had been proven that they didn't come and the end of the world didn't come. So they cited Jehovah's Witnesses as an example, and it was this was the founding of this belief of cognitive dissonance. Mm. And what do people do when something like that happens? And they cited the multiple failed prophecies of the Jehovah's Witnesses, and they said rather than abandoning Charles Taze Russell and some of the others, people doubled down. And they stayed. So rather than leaving over this issue of blood transfusion, they're going to find a way to justify it in their mind to quell the cognitive dissonance.
I find it really fascinating in some ways, you know, how
the
mind works. Mm-hmm. It's a mystery in many ways. Yeah. Even to me, and I've been a member of the cult, and you mentioned you were a member of the evangelical.
Oh, yeah. I was raised fundamentalist. Well, there was a couple things I wanted to circle back around. You mentioned there's three other cult markers that, as you were describing your story about the blood transfusion, I was thinking Robert J. Lifton, he wrote kind of the book on cult psychology and how brainwashing worked coming out of communist China in the Korean War. And three of the markers that he talks about out of his, he got eight actually. One of them is what he calls sacred science, which is sort of the doctrine of the group is held up as, you know, the truth, the absolute truth, whether it's the Bible or the Watchtower magazine, which you mentioned, you study that in your kingdom halls. And then the other one is doctrine over person. So as you say, the person who's been told to shun, they are thinking themselves, well, the doctrine tells me that I have to shun my son or daughter. So I feel terrible about this, but the doctrine is telling me what I have to do. So I'm going to go with that over the person. And then of course, the last thing is what he calls dispensing of existence, which is the shunning piece. You have no longer part of this group. You essentially have no right to exist anymore. So we are going to dispense with you, and you no longer, to us, you no longer exist. It's as if you're dead. So there's at least three more markers according to Lifton's model.
Oh, absolutely. Every single of the ones you mentioned just there now are also applicable, you know, very much to Jehovah's Witnesses. This thing you said about a doctrine over person and also the ultimate truth.
Yeah, sacred science.
Obviously, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses do believe that they have the truth.
And the New World Translation.
Yeah, and you know, their kind of reading of the Bible is the only true one and all that stuff. But what I find scary, really, actually, in this sense, I would refer to Jehovah's Witnesses as a group having the markings of a doomsday cult, not just any cult. Is that, you know, obviously they do believe in Armageddon, it's going to come, and everyone who's not a witness is going to die a terrible, ugly death. The thing that I find scary is, I can't remember if I read it or if I saw it in a video, but Jehovah's Witnesses, in their literature, which comes from the governing body and the people who write this, they literally are expected to follow whatever is written in the publications to the letter, no matter what. I believe the example, I think it might have been used at a congregation. I'm not exactly sure now. Don't hold me to it. But I know for a fact that this is a belief among Jehovah's Witnesses at the moment. The way it went was something along the lines of, if we wrote in the publications something you didn't understand and it seemed weird, you still need to do it. You need to trust us. Mm-hmm. I think it was in relation to the Great Tribulation, which is the period immediately before the Armageddon, when they expect to be attacked and persecuted. I'm certain they use the example of Jehovah's Witnesses being banned in Russia as, you know, the Great Tribulation is coming because this is starting to happen. But It's the thinking that the governing body, they know, they have like a direct line to God, and they know what to do with their flock of 8.5 million people. Mm-hmm. So you may not understand what we're asking you to do, but you need to do it, which really is this. You can't see my hand now.
This is very small.
An audio, but it's like half an inch. It's half an inch from being asked to drink a cup of liquid, and you don't know what's in it, and next thing you know, you're dead.
Yeah, the drinking the Kool-Aid, literally.
Literally, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and that's what happened to Jonestown.
Exactly. So, you know, there's this side of Jehovah's Witnesses that the world knows, which is they're neat, they're hardworking and honest, and they're maybe a bit weird. They're really into their Bible, or whatever, but they're grand. Like they're harmless.
Another Christian group. That's what they present themselves as, don't they?
Yeah, but there is another side to it, and it's so dark, and it's so scary, and it's so dangerous.
It's true. Well, I just had a recent podcast with Renee Cordesky from Sydney, Australia.
Oh, yes.
She was protesting. They had a huge Jehovah's Witnesses conference in Melbourne.
Melbourne, yes.
In the 22nd through the 24th of November, just a few weeks ago now. Mm-hmm. And her group, as ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, were protesting, and they called it Love Never Shuns, because the theme of the conference was Love Never Fails, which is highly ironic. She told me that what's interesting about the Love Never Fails bit is, from the Jehovah's Witnesses' point of view, they're saying, well, it is the most loving thing that we can do to shun somebody. And maybe they'll repent, you know, as it were, because they're being treated so badly. It's the right thing to do. It's the loving thing to do, actually. You can find biblical evidence, though. I mean, look what Paul says in 1 Corinthians. You know, there's this guy caught up in sexual immorality, and he says, cast this man out of your church, turn him over to Satan, and when he's buffeted and slammed around, he'll see the error of his ways, and he'll repent and come crawling back, which is essentially the same kind of philosophy, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, it's hardly obviously loving what it is. It's manipulative, and people who do come back, I never would judge them. I get it. My heart goes out to them. But people who do come back because they can't cope with being shunned, what kind of love do they have for God and other Jehovah's Witnesses? They, you know, it's never going to be honest or genuine, because, you know, it's manipulative. The whole thing is one huge manipulation and cruel, forcing people to do things that they otherwise wouldn't. My heart goes out to people who either, you know, went back to the organization and live a life of lie, if you know what I mean, for the sake of staying with their family. Although I respect that, and if I was in a similar situation, I probably would, you know, do the same thing. It blows my mind how, you know, the powers that be inside Jehovah's Witnesses organization don't see that this isn't how it works. That's not how you make people stay or come back to the organization, by...
You're manipulating them, really, aren't you?
Yeah, trying to destroy their lives. Yeah.
But yet, what's fascinating, though, is that you can take the ideology out of the Jehovah's Witness organization, and you find cult to cult to cult, group to group to group, they all practice a form of dispensing of existence, to put it in Lifton's words. They do it in Scientology, Mormonism, evangelical Christianity, other mainstream cults do it. So it's a universal treatment. And that is, as you said, it is one way that groups like that, groups with undue influence, we could say, control and manipulate their followers. The fear of being shunned, if you see it happening to someone else, because I remember Renee saying that she said when she was a little girl growing up as a Jehovah's Witness in Sydney, Australia, she saw a person in her kingdom hall that had been declared an apostate and had been shunned. And then this person, you know, repented, in air quotes, like you said, came back in, but they never treated that person exactly the same. And she saw that as a little girl and said, I don't want that to happen to me. So I'm going to make sure that I don't get shunned and, you know, booted out as an apostate. So even then, the patterns run very deep, because she saw that and said, whoa, I don't want that to happen to me.
That's true. I feel like, you know, people who had been shunned and came back, they can never win, because they will never be indeed treated the same way. I was speaking recently to Jason Wynn, the founder of this website called avoidjw.org. Mm. He is quite well-known activist from Ireland, from Galway here as well. And he told me that after he had been disfellowshipped for the first time, because he was disfellowshipped twice, that after he was disfellowshipped for the second time and eventually came back, that he also was never treated the same way, because, you know, it's like you have a kind of ugly mark on your face or something. You know,
you're branded for life. You might as well have a letter on your shirt or something, or a dress.
Exactly. You're not to be trusted. But I remember, funnily, I never got disfellowshipped myself. I faded, you know, years later.
Kind of disappeared, huh?
Yeah, it kind of helped that I moved to another country. Right. Couldn't get me here. But right. I remember initially when I was kind of, you know, I went from being hyperactive as a Jehovah's Witness to zero activity because I had, you could, I suppose you would call it a mental breakdown or nervous breakdown if when I was like 20 or something, in my first year at university. And I remember being preemptively shunned by the members of my congregation just because I became what they would refer to as not spiritually uplifting company.
Right. You were a dangerous person.
Because I was depressed and I was down and sad and nothing.
Watch out for her.
Yeah. Oh, stop. And I had nothing, you know, happy and biblical to say and, you know, whatever. But funnily, what I remember what I thought and felt at the time, I didn't, you know, now I'm, oh, don't get me started. But back then, I didn't go, hang on a second, this doesn't seem right. Well, how come you're not my friends anymore? I didn't do anything wrong. I'm just in a vulnerable place.
Yeah, you're struggling.
Yeah. But instead, I remember feeling more guilty and feeling like, you know, I should step up my game. I should like snap out of it and, you know, and preach more and pray more and be more active so they can love me again. I can be deserving of their love. Oh, yeah.
So hard to deal with, isn't it?
Crazy. The guilt, you know, the feeling guilty. It was like a sludge, you know, like a slime. It was like living in a container filled with slimy sludge. It was like literally you'd swallow it and breathe it. Mm. Guilt was permeating. Is that a word? Permeating?
Yeah, yeah.
Every cell of my body, that I wasn't a good enough witness, that I should try harder. You know, if I was pioneering, and which means like spending X amount of hours per month preaching, you know, if I was an auxiliary pioneer, that's not good enough. I should be a regular pioneer, or why not like special pioneer or a missionary? Never good enough.
You never live up to the expectations. No. And that's a common thread though. You hear across religions and cults too, is that it's always thrown back on the person. If you have doubts, it's of the devil. Or if you're depressed, it's something. Yeah. You're spiritually weak. Yeah. It's something wrong with you. You've got to figure out what's wrong with you and fix yourself, as it were.
Never with
God's help, though, somehow, you know.
That's it.
Depression, if it's, you know, clinical depression is not something you can just snap your fingers and go, you know what, I need to shake this off and move on, man. I've got to get, you know, get past this. You might need medication or something like that. It has nothing to do with spirituality.
Professional help, yeah. Like, I was lucky, I guess, because, you know, I did end up fairly quickly as soon as I was, you know, at university and dealing with that depression. I think I lasted maybe a year as a hyperactive Jehovah's Witness, but then I did end up seeing a psychologist, one, and then another one, and then another one, and like for many years. But thank God for that, because, you know, I owe them a lot of kind of, you know, the waking up process and my recovery. But I do believe, even though somebody commented recently under one of the other podcasts or interviews I did, where we talked about mental health, you know, and somebody was giving out, somebody sent a link to the person who runs the podcast, who's a Jehovah's Witness, and it was a link to the official publication on the JW.org website saying that, you know, it's a propaganda article, like, saying if you do have like bipolar disease or any other mental illness, you may need some professional help. But the reality is, that's what may be said in publications, but, you know, if you talk to the elders in the congregation or other brothers and sisters, they all see outside mental, it's part of this thing, these people are outside, they are the world people,
right? Yeah.
And
it could be bringing Satan in this thing, you know.
Exactly. And you're much better off, you know, the best cure for depression is increasing the amount of preaching time you do.
Throw yourself into
exactly things.
Well, I did say that it has nothing to do with spirituality, but in a way, though, I was going to double back on that and say, actually, though, they're not going to admit that perhaps it's the religion itself that's causing the depression and the anxiety and everything else. Because I've read an article by this one woman. She's a counselor, and she sees a lot of Christian evangelical patients. A lot of her clients are Christian fundamentalists and evangelicals. And she said, after doing this for years and years and years, I basically compiled a list of the common symptoms in virtually every single one of my clients. And depression is the number one thing, anxiety, hell-induced PTSD. And she just kind of went down the list and she said, virtually every one of my evangelical clients that comes, by the time they come to see me, they need help. And they all have the pretty much the same cluster of symptoms. And it's their religion that's causing all these things. And they can't see that. And she helps them to see it's all the stuff that you're being taught. It's the context that you're in that's contributing largely to your depression and your anxiety. Amazing.
I know, it's mind blowing. It's so true. Yeah. I remember, it was a really slow process because I kind of grew up, you know, maybe not from like year one, but from a small child,
very young age. Yeah.
So it was like my DNA was fused with the religion. It was, you know, really running deep inside my veins.
Your identity.
Exactly. So I remember that process of, you know, deciding that this isn't the true religion and I don't want to be part of it. And also, by the way, I think I'm an atheist. All of that took, I think, 10 years, if not more, altogether, you know. Mm. You know, when you have water kind of changing the shape of, say, rocks, mm-hmm. kind of slow erosion, that takes forever. This was what it was like, I think, for me, the undoing. And that's why I have great respect for any psychologist that works with people who are inside a cult, because it's really hard work. I remember like the feeling of animal terror or animal-like terror when on the day I actually decided I will never be a Jehovah's Witness again.
I'm done with it. Officially done.
It was so terrifying.
It is. Yeah. The giving up the fear of hell and other things like that are, it's existential threat. It's the biggest threat that they can throw at you. It literally is. There's nowhere else you can go from there.
Yeah. But also for me, it was like giving up the genuine belief in eternal life.
Yeah. Suddenly, if they're right, you're wrong. Now you're forever wrong.
Suddenly my life expectancy went from, you know, hopefully forever to just the regular, whatever, 80, 90, maybe 100 years. I became, you know, just a regular person like all the other people in the world who have a limited lifespan and they are all trying to do their best with it. It was like giving up literally eternal life.
It's absolutely huge. You will not live forever on a paradise on earth. That's, you know, I remember reading that book. You can live forever in paradise on earth. I think something like that, isn't it? That's a
red cover.
Yeah, a Watchtower publication.
My mom studied. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember because I used to be, when I was an evangelical, one of my big things was sort of what I called like counter cult ministry. I used to, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and people would come to the door and I would argue and argue and argue with them. Never got anywhere. We'd argue about the Greek and the Hebrew and everything else, you know, the New World Translation. Never got anywhere, never convinced them, and they didn't convince me.
Without spoilers, if somebody hasn't seen it, but there's a TV show called The Good Place. It's on Netflix.
Yeah, I've heard about it. I haven't seen it.
Like I said, I'm not going to give you any spoilers, but it's basically the lead protagonist wakes up it's like in the first scene of episode one. It's not a spoiler. She wakes up and she's told she's in heaven. She's dead and she went to heaven. But the heaven doesn't quite correspond to, I suppose, anyone's expectations of it. And it's very funny, quite poignant as well at times.
I've heard that, yeah.
I'm just laughing that, you know, when I think of that paradise that Jehovah's Witnesses were promising, it probably would have looked like that.
The expectations don't fit. Well, maybe in the last little bit, we can get into your movie that you're trying to make. We haven't talked about your film yet. It's going to be called Debutante. What's the title about and what the film is going to be about?
Sure. First of all, if there are people still listening, thanks for being patient. Debutante is a short narrative drama. So I just want to say that it's not a documentary. Mm-hmm. I get that a lot. Whenever I mention I'm making a film about Jehovah's Witnesses, people just naturally assume it's a documentary. So It's intended as a cinematic and emotional drama instead. And the title itself refers to the French origin of that word, debutante. And it stands for a person who begins life as an adult or someone who's stepping out into the world for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So my protagonist is a teenager, Meg, who... how will I put it? I'm always struggling with this. I hate saying, what's your film about? Without spoilers.
I know, you don't want to spoil it.
Yeah. Basically, the film is about a loss of faith. It's about the first and early experience of a relationship and sexuality, confronted or clashing with the strict, unforgiving rules of a religion. In this case, obviously, Jehovah's Witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the damage caused to a human being by overbearing religious control and shunning among Jehovah's Witnesses. So very briefly, it's about a pair of teenagers who are both very, very devout Jehovah's Witnesses. I tell the story from the perspective of the girl, Meg, like I mentioned. They spend the night together, even though they are both very devout and obviously premarital sex is not on. But they're 18 and hormones, you know, get in the way. So the film focuses on the experience of what Jehovah's Witnesses refer to as a judicial committee. Sounds terrible, and it's even worse in reality. It's like a pseudo court where Meg is called to explain herself, and she's facing three congregation elders. So there are three of them, and she's on her own. She can't bring anyone with her. And the way they treat her forces her to rethink her faith as a Jehovah's Witness. I'll leave it at that.
Just leave it at that, yeah. You want to see the film when it does finally come out.
Yeah, so where I'm at the moment is I'm crowdfunding to pay for the production. This is my third film, my third short film. My films were screened in a good few film festivals in Ireland and the UK and Europe and America. So I'm hoping with this new film to reach even more people around the world. That's why I'm crowdfunding, to make sure that I, you know, have enough money to pay for good quality experienced crew and equipment and obviously actors to make it as, I hate to use the word a product because, you know, it ultimately does come from my heart, but it is also a product.
You want it to be professional.
Exactly. I want it to, you know, be professional, be great in a way that would make it get accepted into as many film festivals as possible. This way, delivering my message to as many people around the world as possible as well. Although I do say I'm a filmmaker first and activist the second, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping to shoot the film in January, which is really close.
Very tight deadlines.
Very tight deadlines. So like I said, if you guys are watching it or listening to it, and if you think a film like this would be worth watching or being made, by all means consider chipping in. Like I said, I'm at an astonishing 25% of my target.
Hey, 25%. So how can people get a hold of you if they want, other than, okay, they can look in the show notes for the link to the crowdfunding site. How do they get a hold of you? Are you on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram?
I'm a dinosaur in the sense of I don't have an Instagram account at all, but I am on Twitter.
That's how we found each other.
Yes.
On Twitter.
Debutante Film is the handle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also on Facebook. You'll find the page for the film called Debutante Short Film. If you're looking for an image, it's an image of a girl holding a pair of shoes at kind of a dawn background in Dublin. And one more thing I wanted to say is the campaign itself, which you'll add the link to, has really all the information about the film itself, but also my background as a Jehovah's Witness and my background as a filmmaker, which I think are the three kind of key aspects for this project in general. So if that's a site you end up checking out, you'll get all the information there.
The information's out there. Well, it's absolutely been fascinating talking to you. I really hope that people that are listening will give some money, give some funding to your film, and hopefully you'll be able to get it done in January. It's going to be cold, though. Are you sure you want to do it in January? Are you filming it indoors or outdoors?
You know what? It's funny. The reason I chose January primarily is because of the crew members' availability. Mm. Because it's a short film, so even if I raise all the 20,000 euro of the target that I set out to raise, it's still like teeny tiny budget for any film project. Mm-hmm. So, you know, anyone who gets asked to work on a short film is typically kind of going like, oh, right, okay, I'll do it. If you're lucky. But the thing is, the main kind of film industry and commercials industry doesn't quite start in the first couple of weeks of January. So people are more available. And the other reason for that is daytime versus nighttime. Quite a lot of the film takes place at night outside, so exteriors. It gets dark really early in January, which means we can shoot at, you know, 4 or 5 p.m. and we don't have to shoot at 3 in the morning, which I would have to do if we were shooting in August.
You've been very clever about the timing of this film, it sounds like, for a variety of reasons, huh? Cost and availability and when you can film. That's going to be cheaper in the long run. You don't want people getting up at 3 a.m. to have to film, do you? That's a hard schedule to maintain.
That's it. Yeah. So hopefully, and also, you know, there's the timing to do with film festivals. I'm hoping to have it ready and finished by the summer, which is kind of corresponds to the deadlines of submission.
You've got a tight deadline ahead of you. You've got a lot of work to face just in the next few months, it sounds
no
like.
No pressure.
No pressure at all.
What I also wanted to say is, if you guys are listening to it, you know, if you can contribute, that's amazing and please do. But if you can't, that's cool. But what is just as helpful nearly is if you just share the link to the mm-hmm. campaign on your social media, or, you know, if you're friends with like a big journalist, let me know.
Yes,
it's basically the number of people that get to see the campaign really nearly determines its success.
That's it. So yeah, if people are listening, what they can do is share your short clip that you have talking about the movie. I watched it the other day. I shared it on Facebook and Twitter, although I said that it was about sexual abuse in the Watchtower. And then you said, oh, actually, no, it's more about shunning. I thought it was about that because that's the big topic item, isn't it? One of the major things that everyone's talking about now. But anyway, at least it's been shared anyway. We'll keep sharing it. So thank you so much, Camila. Yeah, it's been absolutely a pleasure talking to you. I wish you all the best with your project. Please keep in touch and let us know how you're getting on.
I will. And thank you so much, Ben. Such a pleasure talking to you.